This is Philosophy 201 Ethics. It is Wednesday, October 5th, 2011. And so today we're going to begin with the question, why be moral when you can get away with being immoral? Or as Glaucon puts it, the character in Plato's dialogue, why be just when you can get away with being unjust? And that question relies on certain assumptions about the nature of justice and what might be some of those assumptions. And we're going to use justice and morality interchangeably here. I think there is a difference. Justice is a particular kind of morality which has to do with fairness or giving people their due or treating people in a kind of a uniform way or not necessarily equally, because not everyone deserves equal treatment. But treating people as they ought to be treated. And that's justice. Morality is kind of a catch-all term, which might include your duty to other people, if you have any, that might include duties to yourself, might be some ideas of honor, or might be different kinds of virtues which have nothing to do with justice, like integrity maybe. But for the intents and purposes of this discussion, we'll talk about just morality in general. Why be moral when you can get away with being immoral? So any thoughts on that? What assumption does that make about the nature of morality? And what does Glaucon assume about morality? Is morality something which is good for you? Yeah, so you had your hand up?
I was just going to say it assumes that morality is a cognitive choice rather than something that we just feel.
Okay, good. So there is this assumption that you have control over whether you're going to be moral or immoral. I suppose the dialogue relies on free will. Because if you don't believe in free will, there's no sense in talking about what choice you ought to make, right? Because you'll make whatever choice you're going to make. And if people inescapably behave in a moral way, then it really doesn't make any sense to talk about whether we ought to be moral or not. So that's a good point. I think Plato assumes that you have a choice over what you do, and that includes whether you're moral or immoral. So when you're trying to decide what you do, where does morality fit in there, or what does this assume about the nature of morality? So you get you first.
Does it assume that being moral is better in some way?
Plato assumes that. Plato, the author of this dialogue, thinks it's better to be moral than immoral. And he, through his spokesperson Socrates, he makes a case later on in the Republic for the nature of for being a moral person. But here we're just getting Glaucon's skeptical challenge. Yes.
Acting just or morally has an assumption that there's some value to integrity. There's some value to consistency, and there's some value to being congruent.
Okay, so there's an assumption that certain things are good. And I think Glaucon might say, well, good for who? So the assumptions about morality. I put this made by let's just talk about Glaucon for a minute. So Glaucon's a skeptic. So he's assuming they have free will, including the choice to be moral or immoral. But what about this idea? Does Glaucon think there's any value in being moral? What do you think? What would Glaucon, if you were to go to Glaucon and say, well, what about, is justice a good thing or a bad thing, or does it depend, or what would you say? Yeah.
A lot of times they say that justice is only good when there's a high risk of being caught or there's severe consequences. Otherwise, it's more beneficial to be immoral. You're not going to get caught.
Right. Justice is intrinsically bad. It's intrinsically bad. Justice is something you want to avoid as an individual. Or, you know, when I say justice here, or the individual. There's a modifier I should have for the word justice. What is it? To make this come out right. There's ambiguity when I say justice. Or is the difference between doing justice and experiencing justice from others? Doing justice, so but you read it something else that we'll get to in a minute, which is like being just as opposed to seeming to be just. But doing justice, what do you have to do when you're being a morally upright person? You're at the here's an example. You're at the drive-thru, and the clerk says, would you like some strawberry sauce with your cheesecake? And you're thinking about that cheesecake, but you're like, oh, I don't know if I really need a cheesecake, and it's kind of expensive. And they ask you what kind of sauce you'd like for your cheesecake. You look at your receipt, and you see they haven't charged you for a cheesecake. And you say, yes, please. Right? So that would be an unjust action. If you're going to be a just person, you have to say, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't order a cheesecake. And then, oh, okay, that must belong to the next person, right? Wrong. But so doing that, what have you done? You've deprived yourself of a free cheesecake. Right? That's a sacrifice. Right? So it requires sacrifice. I suppose you're a married man. You have a traditional monogamous relationship with a promise of sexual fidelity. And you're off at a conference someplace, and there's this really hot babe, or if you're a girl, a guy, or if you're, if you're gay, it's a same-sex member, you know, and so on and so forth. Someone that you're very sexually attracted to appears to be very sexually attracted to you, and says, "Hey, you know, hey, big boy, why don't you come up to my hotel room? It's just me and you at this big conference here, and nobody will ever know." And you know, you don't know anybody at this conference. It's the first time you've been there. It's late at night, the room's kind of emptied out, maybe you're just kind of hanging out at the bar and having a drink before bed, right? So, what do you do? Well, if you're going to be a just person, you'd have to say, no, I'm a married man, I made a promise to my wife or my husband that sexual fidelity, and so you forego a night of torrid pleasure with a really hot member of the opposite sex, right? That's sacrifice. Is that good for you? No, that's bad for you, right? You're missing out on a night of forbidden love. Right? So it's sacrifice. Give up the opportunities for the good things in life: money, sex, power. Whatever else, right? You have to respect other people's rights. Wait your turn, right? You get a chance to like cut in line, right? There's like a really long line. You have a chance to bypass it because you have a friend that works at the place, whatever it is, right? Maybe you have a friend that works in the DMV, and you're one of those people that couldn't take care of something online, and so you're like, oh God, I have to wait in this line. And your friend who works at the DMV says, yeah, 1-3. Right, and comes in and takes care of you. Maybe you got a friend who's a police officer, and you got another speeding ticket. Your rate's going to go up. He's like, I think I can fix that for you, right? You say, oh no, I broke the law. Breaking the law is wrong. I deserve to be punished. No, you say, okay, yeah, let's see what you can do, and I'll buy you dinner, right? So you want to cement that relationship in case you have problems in the future. Start acting like a politician, right? You look at
Any other thoughts or examples? Yes, sir.
Well, as long as you don't run into something like a fatal attraction,
oh, right. Yeah, so you want to avoid that.
But
stay away from the crazies.
Also, what it does is plays into, I think, a basic tendency to be lazy. If I'm in the Home Depot parking lot and I've earned money and I'm going to go buy an electric truck, but I see one in a better truck, I can just take it, put it in my rig, and I don't have to work all those hours to get it.
You say lazy, I say efficiency.
I say lazy.
No, because I can, if I'm more efficient with how I obtain my goods and services, then I have more resources to do the things that I care about. Right? So I save myself some money and then I don't have to work. But maybe if I enjoy working, I can make some more money. I can go on a vacation. I have all sorts of things I can do if I'm not working for my money, or you can be lots of different things here, right? Anybody think of another example? Sacrifice. It's not like it's easy being honest. It's a lot of work to be an honest person and to have integrity and all that stuff. And it's painful. It requires sacrifice on your part. It requires you to press down your natural desires for all the good things in life and to give them to other people. To sacrifice yourself. Who wants to do that? That's bad for the individual. Might be good for society overall, but it's not good for you. It's good for the people that you don't steal from and don't then keep your promises for and so on. It's intrinsically bad. So somebody said it depends. What was your name there with the hoodie sweater that says Lane on it? Yeah.
Jackson.
So Jackson made the point that it only makes sense to be just if you, if there's a very high chance of getting caught or a very large penalty, right? So speeding, low chance of getting caught, kind of a low penalty if you haven't gotten a ticket in the last year or two. If you're not driving like a sports car or something. I guess some of you young people, the insurance rates are already high and they'll get jacked way up. But you can go to traffic school, right? Go to one of those comedy traffic school things and sit around over a weekend. It's no big deal, right? So, but then you think about, what if you think about shooting up coke and robbing the 7-Eleven store? Well, that has a big downside, right? Because if you get caught, you might end up going to prison for a strong arm robbery or something like that. That would be that would be really bad. So you got to sort of weigh the consequences. So what Glaucon says is that why does anyone ever behave justly? Well, you behave justly or morally. I'll just put morally here. You behave morally for a good reputation. So it's an instrumental value. Instrumental.
When you're saying reputation, you mean reputation also in like your self appearance, or are you saying to the?
I tell other people, right? So the way other people look at you. Because you might know that you're like a dirty so-and-so, but you don't care because you're being rational. You're like, oh, well, I'm a dishonest person. But, to yourself, you say, how can I fool them today? Or how can I, I think I'll go out and I'll attack millionaires and billionaires, and then next week I'll go out to Martha's Vineyard and eat lobster and hang out with all my Wall Street friends, and then I'll go back on the campaign trail and I'll make another speech bashing Wall Street and talking and playing the class warfare game, right? Or I'll preach sacrifice and altruism to the public and I'll tell people they need to give and not take like a job in the private sector. Meanwhile, I'll like milk my political thing and I'll like give a pittance to charity and nobody will find out. Or people do find out, maybe it'll be in the Washington Times. Who reads that, right? As long as I got the New York Times in my pocket, nobody can touch me. Right, I got MSNBC as my cheerleader, and I got all my Wall Street buddies giving me a bunch of money, and so I might know deep down inside that I'm a dirty so-and-so, but that's like the word, That's a word that the people that believe in justice use for me. What I use, the word I use for me is clever, smart. What's the word?
Shrewd.
Yeah, shrewd. Right. So justice is only an instrumental value, or it's an extrinsic value. So these are important vocabulary words: instrumental or intrinsic, which means. Oops. Dyslexic. Intrinsic. So this is something which is good for what it can get you. So justice is bad in itself, but it's good for what it can get you, namely a good reputation. So if everyone thinks that you're God's gift to the universe, I had a friend, and it's this guy is highly intelligent, which is why it's sort of, and actually fairly cynical overall. And he compared our current president to the Jimmy Stewart character, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. And that just, I didn't know what to say. I mean, he works in Hollywood, so maybe it's sort of part of the culture there or something like that. I'm like, oh, I was speechless. And so, but a lot of people have that image, the image of President Obama. They think that he's honest, he's got integrity, he's against the special interests, he's for the people, you know, and they have all this. So if, hypothetically speaking, he wasn't any of those things, that he was sort of another shyster millionaire lawyer with a privileged upbringing, whose grandmother was a bank vice president, who went to a rich prep school, who went to a bunch of Ivy League schools, wrote on affirmative action scholarships and the connections he made as a community activist, you know, and through a series of circumstances with not very much experience ended up president. So if that's the case, then if you think about, well, now where was I going with this? I got sidetracked. Somebody tell me where I was going with this. Oh, my friend, my naive friend, right? So it doesn't matter to my naive friend, because my naive friend is going to believe that he's, you know, the Messiah, and he's going to vote for him, and he's going to send him money, like political contributions. So it doesn't matter whether he's actually unjust, hypothetically speaking. It only matters whether he seems just to enough people, and to enough the right people, right? People are going to give him money. People are going to go out there and canvas doorsteps, door to door, saying, you know, vote for Obama, right? People are going to put on their marching shoes and throw away their bedroom slippers and get out there and, you know, agitate, right? Put on the marching shoes. And so as long as he's got enough people doing that, he's going to be able to maintain power over the people. He's going to get reelected. He's going to be able to have rock stars and movie stars at the White House and have a party every night and throw in pizza, fly in Pizza Chef from Chicago and jet set off to Hawaii and wherever, and Michelle can go off to Spain, you know, and they can live like royalty, right, while preaching sacrifice and telling people to eat their peas and so on, right? So people are like, oh, okay, you know, he's the president after all, and he deserves the very best. And then he like bashes people flying on corporate jets. Well, he's got his own corporate jet, right? Air Force One, Air Force Two, flying all around. But see, if people don't notice that, like I'd say, like, you know, even bringing something like that this up, you know, I'm like in the vast, vast minority. Most people think he's a great guy. You know, his poll numbers are still good despite our crappy economy. People are blaming the Republicans. So as long as President Obama seems to be just and moral and good, it doesn't matter what he actually is. You know, hypothetically speaking, if he were to seem just and to be actually secretly unjust, it wouldn't make any practical difference. So what Glaucon says is that's the best of all worlds, right? Because if you want to, Glaucon says what you should do is seem to be just and be unjust, or seem to be moral and actually be immoral.
Wouldn't you agree, though, that sooner or later it's going to catch up with you? Your perception is what it is, but your actions are going to eventually take over.
I don't know if you're stupid. I guess if you make a mistake. But the thing is, you could be completely honest, and you could be wrongfully accused, right? I'm trying to think of someone as a good example. Someone who's wrongfully accused. Who isn't Amanda Knox?
The girl who just got off trial from Italy.
Yeah, she was wrongfully acquitted.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of somebody else who's. Well, there's a good example, right? She has all her supporters, and you have the Free Mumia movement, and then you go all but it was like a case of like someone who was pretty clearly, like Dr. Sam Shepard, the guy they made the fugitive movie based on his wife was brutally killed by an intruder, and people thought he did it. He had to go on the run, and it turned out that he didn't do it, and there's really good definitive evidence that he didn't kill his wife, but. He was like a good doctor and a pillar of the community and a really nice guy, and he ended up like on the run for his life for murder, and he did some time in prison and was finally acquitted. But he suffered a lot being innocent, right? So you want to avoid that. You might get punished if you're guilty, but you might get punished if you're innocent too. So really this question is, is it true that crime never pays? So I don't know, any thoughts on that? Like, what about, can you think of any counterexamples? Like, people that seem to, have done really bad things and get away with it?
O.J. Simpson.
Yeah. O.J. Well, see, the thing about O.J., now what would Glaucon say about O.J.?
He's an opportunist.
Well, Glaucon might say, well, first of all, probably he was, really stupid to commit a crime of passion like that and not think it through. Because he was just so sloppy in what he did that any rational jury would have convicted him. Now, it turned out that he fortunately had, Johnny Cochran and a very expensive legal team, and they were able to use play the race card and get him acquitted in a jury in Los Angeles who were primarily African-American. But then he, lost his head again, this sort of, not keeping control of himself. And he went out and tried to get one of his Heisman Trophy back or something like that in a strong arm robbery. How foolish is that, right? So then he ended up in jail a second time. And he lost a bunch of money in civil trial and so on. So I think Glaucon would say that it wasn't being immoral, it was just being stupid about being immoral. So Anthony Weiner, again, that's being stupid about being immoral. What about Chairman Mao? Chairman Mao is lived to a ripe old age. He liked, his minions would bring in, prepubescent girls from the countryside for him to have sex with. He presided over the Cultural Revolution in China, which killed probably 50 million people. Maybe more, maybe between 50 and 100 million. Actually, Stalin's about 50 million. Like Mao, it's, historians differ, but as many as 60 to 100 million people dead through some, I suppose, ridiculous ideological sort of ideas to, taking a bunch of people from the city and throwing them out in sticks and say farm and having people starve to death. But he destroyed, he oppressed people, he destroyed priceless cultural artifacts of China that had to do with religion because he's a godless commie atheist, and took away people's rights, persecuted intellectuals, and led to China being the totalitarian society it is today without much in the way of human rights. Evil, evil, evil man, right? But he lived to a ripe old age and died happy. He's still revered by many people in China today. He's sort of a cultural icon. What's her name? He was on an ornament on the Christmas tree in the White House a couple of years ago. What's her name? I can't think of that woman's name. She said that her two greatest philosophers in her book were Mother Teresa and Chairman Mao. I don't know if anybody remember her name. She was the White House press secretary or White House officer. But, among people of the left-wing persuasion, Chairman Mao is a great guy. Che Guevara, another case. There's a picture of Che Guevara sitting over in enrollment services on a big poster. Now, Che came to a bad end. But, you know, he's still, if his reputation matters, he's you see him on those t-shirts all the time, and people think he's a great guy. They make, Hollywood movies that make him look really glamorous. When he, like, bragged about executing people without trial, and he was just a brutal thug. Yes, sir?
I think that comes down to a matter of one man's trash is another man's treasure. It's all a matter of perception, not necessarily morals.
So this comes back to the relativism thing. So you're saying that, well, really, like, you know, it's just some people would think, like, persecuting intellectuals and leading people to starve to death and putting people in, like, death camps and so on is bad, but it's just a matter of perspective. Now, that's kind of a tough bullet to bite, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the arguments against relativism. But according to Glaucon, there is no such thing as right and wrong. So it's not relative. He's a skeptic. The relativist thing seems kind of weird because you're saying, well, it's right to you, but not right to you. It might be right for them, but not right for them. And it just doesn't make any sense. And Glaucon would say, well, what do you mean right for them? There is no such thing as right and wrong. It's all a bunch of nonsense. And so what he would say is that Chairman Mao, you know, had a great life because he maintained power and he lived like he had power, sex, and money, and he had all the good things in life. And that was what counts. And that's what counts. Yeah.
Did Coffin ever identify anything in his writing that he thought was wrong?
Suffering injustice while being actually just. That's like you're the most wretched of people. Like Socrates, right? Socrates, according to Plato anyway, was actually just, but seemed to be unjust to enough people on that jury that they convicted him, and he had to drink the hemlock and was, you know, and die. So he was executed. And so Glaucon talks about how the worst of all possible worlds is to make all these sacrifices and get punished for it. Well, think about Jesus, right? He goes around trying to help people and heal them, and then he ends up getting crucified for his trouble. Right? Now, I mean, just forget about the sort of God's plan and all this stuff. But I mean, you look at it just sort of on the surface, right? Jesus is going around trying to help people, trying to minister to the sick and the poor, and speaking out against the religious leaders and so on. And then he ends up the corrupt and hypocritical religious leaders, and he gets crucified. Right? And so Glaucon might look at that and say, well, look, there's a guy that went around trying to help people his whole life, and he ends up getting, and speak out against injustice, and he ends up getting killed for his trouble. Right? A martyr, according to Glaucon, is a foolish, pitiable person. Yes, sir?
So, well, like, how would you view, like, doing something bad to achieve something good? Like, dropping the bomb in Japan to end the war?
I think Glaucon might say, well, good for who? I suppose it's, if you're on the American side, dropping the bomb's good. If you're living in Hiroshima, drop the bomb's bad. So it's a matter of doing injustice or suffering injustice. You want to be the one who's doing injustice. You don't want to be the one who's suffering injustice. It's like if you take a little kid and the little kid like hit his playmate over the head with a brick and stole lunch money, right? And you sit him down and say, now Johnny, how would you feel if someone hit you over the head with a brick and stole your lunch money? And he says, but nobody will ever do that because they're afraid of me. That you want to be the one who does injustice and that everybody's afraid of. You don't want to be the one like the victim that suffers injustice because you're like seen as a ripe target because you don't fight back or because you're scrawny or whatever. You want to be the one who does injustice. So what would you say against Glaucon, right? What arguments might you make against him? He's assuming injustice always bad for you. Sometimes it's a necessary evil, right? Suppose the
your boss and like a really, really hot looking wife, and she's making eyes at you, and you're making eyes at her, and the boss walks in, and you're like, oh crap, I'm gonna get fired. And this job is like really, really important to you. And suppose the job is more important than like, you know, a night of passion, right? So what you need to do, Glaucon would say, is as a necessary evil, you need to refrain from having relations with your boss's wife. Why? Because you want to avoid being fired. Now, you might try to bump off the boss or get him fired or you know, do something behind the scenes, you know, and then kind of move in, right? Ideally, what you want to be the boss. And then maybe if you're the boss, maybe the boss's wife, if she thinks like you do, she'll dump her husband and be with you. So that's sort of the way Glaucon thinks. It's a necessary evil. In the meantime, you have to restrain your baser impulses if you don't have the power to do so, or there's going to be a really big consequence. The same thing if you get in some altercation in a bar and somebody threatens you. You might think, well, if I get in a bar fight now, I might end up in jail, because typically if the police show up, they take both the guys and throw them in the drunk tank or hold them overnight. And you know, even though you might be acquitted, you don't want to go through an arrest, and you just kind of think, yeah, I'd really like to punch that guy in the face, but I'm not going to do it. Not because it would be wrong, but it's just because you want to avoid trouble with the law. You want to avoid getting in trouble. And so this is the way Glaucon thinks. So the question is, why wouldn't you think like this? Isn't this what you should think as a rational person? What's in it for me? What can I get away with? Now, if you really believe this, what would you say when you're hanging around your friends or in polite company?
Not sure what you mean.
Oh, like so. Suppose this is you're like Glaucon, you're like slinking around the shadows looking for some opportunity to do some injustice. Well, then, but when you're around other people, do you say this? No, you praise justice. You say, oh yeah, today I was down at the animal shelter and helping adopt out puppies, right? And after that I went down to the soup kitchen and and helped out the homeless people or whatever, right? You try to make it sound like you're a really good guy. So then when you're like in a bad place, people say, oh my God, Bardell, he's such a good guy. And he's so honest, and maybe I'll lend him that $500 that he said he sort of. But he would never use it on cocaine. Yeah.
Well, everyone's starting to sound like he's having a lot of trouble controlling his baser urges. He's slinking around in the shadows of the night.
Well, I mean, it's not like he can't control them. It's just that he only gives in to them, I suppose you can use that language. He only goes after what he wants if there's not going to be a bad consequence. It's like, what is that expression? When the cat's away, the mice will play, right? So, what happens when there's like, you're out in the middle of nowhere and there's like no cops anywhere? People put the pedal to the metal, right? People speed. What do they do when they come into town? They know there's a speed trap, they slow down, right? If you're like at a four-way stop and you're looking both ways and there's no cops, you just kind of roll through it, right? You don't just stop because that's what you should do, because that's the rule. But when there's no enforcement of the rules, people tend to ignore them. So why would you ever be moral? Why would you ever sacrifice yourself for other people?
From Glaucon's point of view or something?
Yeah, or just from any point of view. So I'm giving you Glaucon's cynical argument.
Just for your reputation on the outside, rather than helping get his
what you want, and then keep things to yourself so everyone thinks,
like, just so you manipulate
the more into what you want. Is that how it works? Yeah. Yeah, so you don't want to, like, I suppose if you're like a gossip and you gossip with everybody in the office, you're going to develop a reputation as a gossip, and then no one's going to trust you with inside information. So what you want to do is, feign scruples, right? You just let the person tell you just a little bit so you get the gist of it, and you say, no, I don't want to hear any more of this. I shouldn't be doing this, and you develop your reputation as a person who can be trusted with the confidential information because you're so upright and trustworthy.
I was pushing this line at a philosophy conference, and a sort of overzealous person said, you vouted yourself. You're like, you know, he thought I was, you know, well, he didn't realize I was playing the devil's advocate. And so he just thought that I was being serious. I'm like, I'm going to keep an eye on you. But, like, of course, if I thought like this, I would never, like, push it to class. That would be ridiculous. I'd be talking about, I don't know what I'd do. I'd be pushing a utilitarian viewpoint or something. So I mean, this is a tough question, right? Why should you be moral? And actually, Plato's got a couple of answers for this. So one of the things he says is that, and you brought this up about, like, the baser impulses. So he says if you're living like Glaucon says, you're kind of living like an animal. You're like a brute beast. You're living according to your bestial desires for food and sex and power over your environment. You're not really living as a rational person. A rational person is the moral person. If you're living according to these base animal desires, you're not really living as a human being. You ever hear, like, someone's convicted of some horrific crime, and people say, that person is just an animal, right? Oh, you know, put him down as a rabid dog he is, or something like that. Right? People will make those comments, and there's this idea that if you're kind of going around and fixated on these baser impulses, that you're not really living as a full-fledged human being. What do you think about that idea?
Yeah, I mean, this just seems more an opinion, really. I mean, what is human? How can you think? There's no real label to that.
Well, human beings can, like, have contracts and keep promises, and they can help other people. Like, animal, you look at the animal kingdom, and I mean, there's some altruism in, like, the sort of the higher level animals, but mostly a lot of the jungles kill or be killed. And one of the things that separates man from the animals is that, you know, human beings can work together in groups and keep promises and observe contracts, and they have scruples, and they don't take advantage of every opportunity to exploit their fellow human being. So how about that? You say it's opinion, but, I mean, do you want to live like an animal, just going around and, you know, having sex with everything that moves, and always thinking about money, how can I get more money, and not thinking about the loftier things in life, like, you know, and the virtues of integrity and honesty. I'm not convincing myself yet. But there is this idea, right? You don't want to live like a dog. Well, there's this idea, this is a statement, right? Men are dogs when it comes to sex. And so this idea that maybe you sow some wild oats when you're young, but then, you know, you settle down and get married and have a family and you, like, become a pillar of the community. That's sort of what you should do. That's when you get maturity, right? You become a more mature person. You become a full-fledged member of the community by shouldering responsibility, by working for a living, by raising children, by being a member of the community and maybe helping out at some, you know, charitable function. Thoughts? Yeah.
But this model wouldn't work well in my marriage. I mean, if I value loyalty or companionship or honesty or friendship, intimacy, honesty, none of that will work if I use this model.
Yes, it is.
There's a practical benefit for rejecting this, at least on some level.
So is friendship or love really possible, you know, on this view? Well, I suppose it depends how you regard it, yeah.
Well, I mean, if someone's priorities are different, and let's say your priorities are like family and friendship and love, you can still do unjust things to move those priorities forward.
So you're thinking maybe you have, like, a relationship with, like, one person or a group of people, kind of honor among these, and then you can, like, your victims will be, like, the other people, the marks, the outsiders or something.
Yeah, or I guess, like, if your priorities are family and you want to get your kids into a program and you have an unjust way of doing that, you're benefiting your family and yourself.
Yeah, so you might think, well, my values are my family, and my family, like, they rely on me, and so we have this sort of relationship in history. And so I think that, and what I want to do maybe is make sure it's going to be in their interest not to stab me in the back. And I want to do that by, like, being valuable to them. If I'm valuable to them, then they're going to reciprocate, not because they love me for myself, but because I do all these great things for them, and they do great things for me in return, and we have this back and forth. Let's see. Yes. Did somebody else have their hand up? Yeah.
It's kind of like the guy who murders people and throws them in the lake, or a creek, or river, or whatever. You know, maybe he throws up the first time and he completely hates himself and he's guilty, but the thrill that it made him go back and keep doing it, then it felt like kind of natural.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, if you're not that kind of person, you probably wouldn't be doing those things because you just don't want to. But if you're that kind of person, it would work for you. Or you become that person, and if you don't like it, you can always go back. I mean, it's not like this is what your choice is, period. You know, this is just what Lockie's saying, like, about morality, and if that's your
moral
support.
Okay.
Is that kind of what...
That's a view that Glaucon's pushing. Plato tries something else here, too, for as a rebuttal. He says it's a kind of a sickness of the soul. Or we might even say, today, mental illness. It's a sickness or disharmony. And this idea of a disharmony or imbalance goes back to the earliest forms of medicine. And it was thought that if you had some disease, there was something going on in your body that where things are kind of out of whack, we might say today. And so you can have people's bodies get out of whack and their minds can get out of whack. And so the idea is that your serial killer and your perpetual criminal and your immoral person has problems with impulse control. There's something wrong with their mind. And again, Plato goes back to this idea that the desiring part of your soul gets control over the rational part of your soul, and it sort of trumps it, and that you're going around, you know, doing things that you shouldn't. Why? Because your desires have kind of gotten out of control. I suppose you might say that, well, that's not necessarily true. It might be true of, like, the drooling psychopath, but it's not true of, like, the careful criminal, maybe the head of a narco crime, you know, this crime family, or a Hollywood producer, or an inside trader or whoever, right? Pick your favorite villains. Those are people that have desires for lots of all the good things in life, but they go through very methodically to get them. And they keep their desires in careful check, probably as much as, or maybe even more so than other people. I think I'm going to leave that hanging in the air until we come back to Ayn Rand with egoism. You know, I think you'll see some overlap here. I want to talk for a few minutes about David Hume and his view called emotivism.
Could you explain extrinsic and
extrinsic? Oh, sorry. Extrinsic is the same as instrumental. So intrinsic means valuable for its own sake. Extrinsic valuable for something else, also known as instrumentally valuable.
So they're interchangeable?
Yeah.
Okay.
David Hume, father of modern liberalism, classical liberalism, also known as conservatism or minarchism, this sort of idea of limited government. A lot of these ideas of limited government, which were influential on the Founding Fathers, come from Locke, but also from David Hume. David Hume was also best buds with Adam Smith, father of capitalism. And so David Hume has this view of morality, though, that morality is really it's a matter of emotion. And so he calls it emotivism. Or actually, this is a little, I should say, emotivism is a term later on added to Hume's view that's used by scholars today.
He would call it, it's a theory of natural sentiments. And so Hume's view is called emotivism, and this is the idea that morality is fact. Morality is feeling, not fact. That when you're dealing with morality, really you're dealing with feeling of a certain sort, not fact. And so when you say something like, what would be a statement about morality? Where you say something's right or wrong? Give you an example. Those bastards on Wall Street should pay for what they did to us, right? That's what people in the march around in the big metro areas are saying now, as they call for more sleeping bags and free food and place to juice up their iPods while they go protest against the evils of capitalism, which created their iPod. But be that as it may, so they're saying those Wall Street bastards should pay for what they did to us. So then the question is that a statement of an objective fact, or is that a statement about feeling?
Yeah.
It's feeling, right? And so what's the word in there? You get this word should. Words like should or ought, they sound like objective language, but really they're an expression of personal feeling. So what that person means is, I really, really don't like those people on Wall Street, and I really, really wish that they would pay for the negative effect they had on my life and on the lives of people that I care about and feel some camaraderie with. But it's all feeling, right? If someone says abortion is immoral, they're saying, well, I find it really distasteful and gross, and it really bothers me and gives me a feeling, bad feeling in the pit of my stomach when I think about, you know, little babies being killed in the milk. If a person says abortion is a right to choose, they're saying something like, well, I don't like it when other people tell me what I can do with my own body, especially if it's another man. If it's a man telling me what I can do with my own body, that makes me angry or something. So it's just a matter of feelings and emotion. And so if you say this statement like murder, a wanton murder is wrong. So this really means I don't like murder. Or, you know, I wish there were no murders. And there's you can take any turn where you're talking about something being wrong or right or good or bad, evil, right? Like if I say Chairman Mao was an evil, evil, evil man, I could say, well, you know, I really don't like Chairman Mao. Why? Well, because he was a murderer and because he persecuted intellectuals. Well, I'm an intellectual, right? And so he persecutes people who I perceive to be like me, and so I see him as especially bad. I love culture and history. He destroyed priceless cultural and historical artifacts in the culture of China. I like Asian culture. I find it very interesting. And he destroyed all that stuff. So that means I really, really don't like him. So that's what, when I say that he's immoral or he's a bad person, what I'm saying is just that I don't like him. I don't like dictators. There is no objective truth to the matter, Hume says, that either he's good or he's bad, or that dictators are bad, or that genocide is wrong. It's a feeling in the speaker which they're expressing in sort of misleading language, which sounds like objective, object language. Like if I say, my umbrella is really big, right? That's an objective language statement, right? And how do we tell? Well, we look at the umbrella. Oh, shelf size, right? Really, really, really big. So that's an objective statement. But what if we say, like, murder is wrong, or how about capital punishment is unjust?
Is that kind of like perspective?
Well, it's not. Well, I mean, in a sense, it's relative, but it's not relative to some. It's not like there's some world of morality which applies to individuals or cultures. It's just that there are feelings that people have. So it's relative to the person, but it's not. This isn't relativism. It's because it's non-factual. I think a cultural relativist or a subjectivist will say there are certain moral facts, and they apply to either groups or individuals. David Hume would say that morality only applies to individuals, and it's a matter of how people feel. It's a matter of their sentiments. And in particular, he thinks that the sentiment of sympathy is really important. I talked about this, I think, on the first day. Human beings have this sense of squeamishness, right? When you see somebody, they hit their shin on something really hard. You ever get like that feeling in your own leg? Like you see someone like just really whack their leg, and they're like, ah, like that. And you like kind of feel this kind of weird vibration, going up like from your shin, vibrating up to your knee. And it's like a sympathetic reaction. Or, I'll stand by if you see some guy, hitting a testicle with a large object, right? You see him double over in pain, you're like, ooh, right? People grimace and they kind of scrunch up. Sometimes they kind of put their legs together a little bit like that, right? It's like, but it's not happening to you. You might be watching it on television, right? I remember watching this operation show where they're showing open heart surgery. I'm like, wow, I've never seen open heart surgery. That's so cool. I'm like, oh, I don't feel very good. I'm about to change the channel. And I didn't like realize it, but it's that innate squeamishness. Yeah.
What if you can't relate to that though?
Well, then you're like a psycho.
Huh?
Then you're a psychopath. Something's wrong with your brain.
It's a specific thing.
Well, no, a woman is like, it's not as much because they don't have the same reaction there. So,
yeah.
And that's the thing. Same thing. Like people, like a racist, can kill a person of another race and feel no guilt because they don't perceive that person as being like them. They have no sympathy for them,
yeah.
But they might have a sympathy for a person of the same race.
Like if you've never tore anything in your knee, or ever not broken your ankle, or broken a toe, then you're like, oh, ow, that probably hurts.
But those things are they're kind of visceral. So that's why I like using those examples. But there are cases, like, there's some people, like, if a rich person has something bad to them happen, some people say, well, good, they deserve it, because rich people are evil, right?
Yeah.
That's their view. So people don't have, they have certain people they consider to be bad, and they sort of deserve what they get. And there's other people who they think are deserving of protection and help. And so, it depends on the person. Because where do these feelings come from? And some of them come from human nature. So Hume actually thinks that the natural feelings we have are biological. They come from what he calls human nature. That we're social creatures, and we have these innate feelings of sympathy for other people. So you have this reaction where you irrationally associate the misfortune of other people with your own possible or actual misfortune. So you think, well, what if that was me, right? Hume says that's what you're thinking, at sort of maybe at a subconscious level, we might say, when you see an old little lady who's assaulted and has her purse stolen. And you're like, well, what if that was me, or what if that was my grandmother that I love, or what if that was a family member? And then that gets kind of abstracted into these principles of morality, where people say things like, all men are brothers, or we're all part of the human family. And so that's just kind of like an abstracted version of this kind of tendency we have to associate our suffering with that of other people. But Hume says there's nothing rational about it. It's just the way we're made, where we're social creatures. And even today they've discovered these things called mirror neurons, which seem to have something to do with feeling sympathy or empathy for other people. Where there's this, that when you see something happening to someone, neurons in your brain activate, which are similar to what would happen if you were actually experiencing that thing. And so this is why people cry at movies, and why, you know, some people cried when E.T. died, and other people laughed. The O.J. verdict is a great example. I remember being in Santa Barbara, going back to O.J., 1994 or something. I was in Santa Barbara, California, and I was at the beginning of the school year. I was waiting in line to get registered to get my parking, and they had this TV at the corner of the room, and they read the not guilty verdict. And all around me, the people of color cheered, and the people who were not of color, you know, the pales, they just kind of shook their heads and said, "No, I don't understand that." But you know, there were the people there, African Americans and some Hispanics, they're like, "Yeah." So it was interesting that you get, again, totally different reaction. And why is this? It's because the sympathetic reaction. Not that you can't have sympathetic reaction with a person of a different race. It's just that it's the more natural tendency is to sort of feel an affinity for someone who's like you in whatever respect. Yeah.
Do you think maybe those mirror neurons are more of our world than anything else? Because those, I mean, and you see that mostly with children, even they don't know pain really. Like they see somebody else and they don't know that, but they see crying and they think, that makes me sad. Oh, that makes me sad.
Uh-huh.
So maybe that is more of our morals, of like the innate feelings, because our mirror neurons pick up that emotion.
Right, that's what humans say. He didn't know about mirror neurons or in the biological picture. He just got this from observation that people, he calls it the association of ideas. When you see, what was something that's going to happen? When you see somebody thrown out in the street, say, have all their belongings thrown out in the street because they couldn't pay their rent, you might feel sorry for them, but if you actually had that happen to you, you'd feel even more sorry. Right? If you hear about, say, a sexual assault, and you've been the victim of sexual assault, it's going to bring up a lot more feelings in you than if you've never experienced something like that. The same thing with like a robbery, or if you've had a member of your family who's been, you know, assaulted or murdered, you have feelings about hearing about crime, which are even different from other people. So not only is this natural human nature an operation here, but it's also your experiences and things that you experience, pleasure and pain, that you link pleasure and pain within your mind. And so you like or don't like certain things based on your experiences. So, for example, a person, what would be an example of a case where you might get two people with totally different feelings about something based on their experiences? Think of something where...
I don't know, it's kind of a rough subject, I guess, but the only example I can think of where I think it was a trial where the man was being prosecuted because he was having sexual relations with a woman underage, or a girl. And she didn't mind. She wanted to be with that person because they fell in love. And she was 14, I think, or so, and he was around 30, and so it was, you know, lawfully wrong.
Right.
And then, of course, somebody else being, you know, raped in that way instead of not liking it, and, you know, maybe liking it to a point, but thought, well, you took away my childhood. And some of them think, oh, no, don't take away my lover, but maybe another person would think, well, you stole my childhood away from me, and I didn't get to experience having little kid friends and, you know, seeing things the way that people might.
Right, so how you look at statutory rape might like differ depending on what your experiences might be with sexuality, say. Yeah.
There's a whole different perception in some of the cases where it was a female who had sex with like one of her younger friends.
Right. And so that might be, there might be like biological differences or cultural differences depending on whether it's a man or a woman, and you know, most, I mean, my it seems to me like I would say,
but it's the same statute.
Yeah, same statute, right? I would say most guys, like, if they have, like, this hot 30-year-old teacher, you know, and they're, like, you know, 16, they would think it would be a great opportunity to have sex with that teacher. Yeah. But then there might be someone who, like, as a boy was maybe, like, you know, molested by an ugly stepmother or something like that. They might have different feelings or you know, it's tough to see, like, contextually how these things, you know, how the attitudes can get transplanted, because a person might think, oh, well, you know, a 14-year-old girl, a 30-year-old man, it's bad, but if it's the sexes are switched, maybe they might think it's okay. What about another example? Like, we had two, yeah.
There's like, the people in the store, the few people in the store, you know, there's a certain group of people who are always going in robbing it.
Uh-huh.
You're not going to like those people at all, ever. But then somebody else would have this same group of people go in there all the time and be perfectly fine, and then people would keep going in.
Yeah, so, like, if you're maybe, say, in a heavily minority neighborhood, like, you have these Korean shop owners down in South Central, yeah, that had African-Americans largely and some Latinos, you know, primarily minority groups who were basically trying to burn down their stores, and they were up there on the roof with rifles and hoses trying to defend their property. I mean, you're going to have some strange feelings when you see the same people coming into your store to patronize you, right? It's going to leave an impression. Imagine, like, growing up at that time, right? All of a sudden, like, all the people who looked a certain way, not all the people, but a great number of people who looked a certain way are flooding the streets, breaking out store windows, and burning things. And, like, what's going on? And so you're going to have, like, deep down in your consciousness, you're going to have this sort of attitudes. And these are tough things to overcome sometimes. So Hume would say, and I think another example might be your attitude towards money, right? Some people see money as the root of all evil. Other people see money as, like, a sort of an important tool. A lot of people see business owners as being evil and greedy and bad. And, you know, people who grew up maybe where their father was, like, a middle manager or maybe a small business owner, are going to have very different feelings, right? This is their father. If their father was a good guy and he gave to the community and he provided a good product or service, they have, like, the warm, fuzzy feelings about free market capitalism. And other people who might have grown up poor and might, you know, have had parents who told them that was because the rich people are hoarding all the wealth, why that's why they're so poor. It's not that, you know, dad was on the sauce and, you know, mom took off, or they had kids when they were, you know, teenagers or whatever. But they were told, if you're told when you're very young that the reason why you're suffering is because the rich people have it in for you, then you're going to develop certain attitudes and feelings. Okay, so anyway, Hume's basic idea is that human nature gives you most of your ideas, and that human nature shows you why certain moral feelings are universal. This is why almost all cultures and people disapprove of murder in general, lying in general, stealing in general, and assaulting other people in general, and so on. And this is why you get this big overlap in it, you know, across cultures about what's right and wrong. But also, there are differences in experiences. There's difference in experiences which can kind of tweak that. So, okay, murder in general is wrong, but if it's one of those Wall Street guys hanging from the rafters, right? Or stealing in general is wrong, but if you're taxing 100% any wealth over $100,000, those people don't deserve that money anyway. Or so you can think of the cases where you make exceptions, or you'd say, well, okay, generally this is true, but these people are really bad, or these people, you know, deserve what they get. Or, you know, your feelings about what another example of moral feelings you might have about something. Well, about maybe honesty, right? If you grow up with a family of, like, con artists and thieves, you're going to think, well, as long as you don't hurt anybody, if you're stealing chumps and marks, that's perfectly okay. And as long as you don't harm your mirrors, you're doing all right. And so you might develop those attitudes as well. Okay, so that's Hume's emotivist view. So what might be some problems with this? Just a couple of things. These are in the reading. One is that you really can't have a moral argument because all you're doing is spouting off emotion, right? Morality is really a matter of personal taste. So, suppose I say I like chocolate ice cream, and you say, well, I like tutti frutti. And what am I going to say to convince you, right, that you're wrong? If I say chocolate ice cream is the best ice cream there is, and I'll say, why? Because it's so chocolatey. And you're going to say, but tutti frutti, it's so fruity, right? And there's no common ground there. It's just personal subjective feelings. And so there can be no general moral principles according to emotivism. Maybe some have to do with human nature, but these aren't really binding. And this is the other objection is there's no prescriptive force in emotivism. So remember, this is a form of moral skepticism. So it explains why you lack morally, but it doesn't tell you why you should be moral.
Do you stand again?
It explains why people act morally, but it doesn't tell you why you should be moral. It's an explanation, but it doesn't tell you what you should do. So this is the idea that it lacks, if I can make this up here, it lacks what's called prescriptive force. Prescriptive force means that it's only descriptive. A descriptive statement is one which just tells you how it is. A moral statement tells you how it should be. So a descriptive statement might say, like, I don't know, 10,000 children died in sub-Saharan Africa in the last week. It doesn't tell you whether it's bad or good, it's just a fact, right? A prescriptive statement would say, you ought to do something to stop it, right? That's a moral statement. Emotivism can just say, well, the reason you really feel bad about all these little dead children is because you have this natural sympathy for little babies, because that's sort of biologically built into you, and because you see human beings as being like you, and you have this irrational association between the suffering and death of others and your own possible suffering and death. And that's why you feel bad when you hear about a bunch of innocent babies dying, in the last week due to preventable causes. But it doesn't tell you what you should do about it, if anything. It just says, that's why you feel bad. And that explains why people will sacrifice their own interests in order to help and give away gobs of money that gets spent on their pleasures. But it doesn't tell you that whether you should or shouldn't do that. All right, that's all we have time for today, because I got to get to a curriculum committee. I'll see you on Monday when we're going to start right into the egoism. Don't forget to post to the forum before Sunday, 11:55 p.m. All the topics are up.